subjective and therefore like a mono ethical system that only considers one person. An ethical system, in order to even like encompass the ethical universe or the ethical world that we live in, has to account for interactions between people, and therefore it means you have to like weigh things against each other. It's not just a subjective weighing of your own experiences against your own. You have to be able to somehow weigh your experiences against another person's experiences, which you can't seem to experience, but you have to use a kind of ethical imagination or like an ethical instrument like that to be able to derive, like, because I don't, like, when I think about someone just like weighing their own pleasures against themselves and being like, okay, well, you know, that thing that hurt me was bad and that thing that felt good was good, that doesn't actually, like, as far as saving the phenomena, I don't see an ethical phenomena here, right? This just seems to be a kind of like a kind of introspection. Like, you don't have an ethical phenomena until you see two people having to weigh their experiences against one another or engage in some kind of dialogue or anything like that.
Yeah, it comes down to, it's sort of the problem, or the question becomes, like, you know, does someone completely isolated, like, does someone on an isolated, let's say, a desert island with no one else around, does that person, you know, have ethical duties, or is that person, you know, does that person even make moral decisions, right? Like, if there's, you know, if you're the last guy around and you're on this island and there's nobody and there's never going to be anyone else, you know, your decisions are, you know, comparative to who's, like, nobody's and affect no one other than you. And even you, like, who you are becomes a bit of a question mark within the context of, like, no one else being there either. So I do think that it's like exactly what you're saying. Like, an ethical system has to be something that's applicable. This is kind of what we're saying at the beginning. It has to be something that has some sort of universal quality to it. It's applicable to, you know, the wider human community, and also it's applicable across time too, right? Like, that, I mean, that's probably one of the harder questions, but something that's right or wrong should be consistent from time point one to time point two to time point three, and not magically switch at time point four.
Yeah. I mean, even if something like ethics or ethical ideas or values change, they seem to have some kind of durability, at least from moment to moment, right? Like, if you want to, like, take a... if we're going to use ethics as like a normative system at all, it has to act like some kind of measure, and measures are durable, right? They don't fluctuate. They don't change. You can use them for consistent comparison across cases. And so there's like a minimum need for a kind of durability for ethical guidance if it's not permanent. Ideally, they would be permanent or something. So there would be such a thing as like ethical truth. That's a whole other matter, but there is some minimum need for a kind of durability if we're going to have a normative moral system.
You and I were both reading kind of the last night, the penultimate, or the OG utilitarian or consequentialist, who I guess is kind of advocating for a sort of hedonism, but just like Looper was saying last week, to loop things back in with discussion last week, I guess when we've been kind of talking about like the hedonists, like the simple hedonists, the kind of like easy to assault basically one, but there are people who seemingly have made distinctions that make the system more durable, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
Go ahead.
They've certainly made distinctions within this idea of pleasure and also pains too, to try and salvage hedonism from certain charges, right? John Stuart Mill specifically in Utilitarianism, when he is drawing a distinction between higher and lower pleasures, which we're reading I brought us over to Mill because one of the defenders of hedonism in the Stephen Looper section, Feldman, he also draws on a distinction between higher and lower pleasures, though within the section that we read, Feldman thinks that it's more trouble than it's worth to try and draw this distinction. He draws a distinction between sensory and attitudinal pleasures, so pleasures that have a phenomenology and pleasures that do not have a phenomenology. So a sensory pleasure would be, you know, like eating something that tastes good, whereas an attitudinal pleasure would be cognitive. It would be like being thankful for something or being appreciative. It doesn't really feel like I mean, maybe those do, but specifically states of affairs that please us, right? But he does make recourse to higher and lower pleasures later on to try and sort out or prioritize different kinds of pleasures and how we might value these differently. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that Feldman has encountered Mill. One of the reasons that I wanted to actually bring in Mill is because everyone has read John Stuart Mill, and if you're a student of philosophy or if you're going into studying philosophy, chances are if you are studying any first year ethics classes, you will encounter Mill as well. You will probably even be reading this specific text. Now, John Stuart Mill is the, I don't think that John Stuart Mill was the first person to make this distinction. I know that Epicurus drew a distinction between necessary and unnecessary pleasures as well. But that is not the same thing as what John Stuart Mill is drawing here, which is higher and lower pleasures.
I do think it's it is the obvious like crux of any sort of like serious argument for kind of any sort of hedonism but I guess we're going to make there's a transitional distinction between like hedonism and consequentialism, utilitarianism. But like talking about Mill's and this like distinction of the higher and lower, you know, he kind of famously compares us to like, you know, people, you know, because people are obviously already kind of having the same discussions we're having now, even back in the mid-19th century when Mill was writing. And he's sort of saying, you know, like, the people who say that it's all, like, who assault, you know, like, people like myself, utilitarians, for saying it's all about pleasure, don't understand what pleasure really is. It makes this distinction between, like, kind of animalistic and human pleasures, which is obviously the sort of the altitude we're talking about here. Like, this is actually, I just highlighted this famous quote. He said, Mill said, a beast's pleasures do not satisfy a human being's conceptions of happiness. Human beings have faculties more elevated than animal appetites, and when once made conscious of them, do not regard anything as happiness which does not include their gratification. So basically, like that's like what just we're saying, that human beings have other faculties, interests, concerns that are more important for us to fulfill than just like the base pleasures, which is, I think, like the obvious counter to like the, we use the example of like someone who's just like constantly on narcotics or like drug addiction example, where it's like that sort of lifestyle or whatever is very much like a base, as you said, a very distinct pleasure seeking that has a really distinct sensual phenomenology to it and is not real. Like, here's the thing, like, you could get a person get hopped up on drugs all the time. So can a rat, right? Like both entities are capable of living that kind of lifestyle. And Mill is obviously rejecting that as like, you know, a distinctly human moral way to live.
Yeah. Yes. And it specifically hinges on this apparent fact that humans have faculties that, other animals, lower animals don't have. We have ideas, or we have faculties of intelligibility, of the imagination. We have rational faculties as well. There is a certain kind of pleasure that we derive from being able to think a problem through, make a wise decision. These kinds of pleasures are the distinctly human pleasures. They are the higher pleasures that Mill wants to refer to.
I think that Mill makes a further distinction, though, because we basically, with Feldman and from the Looper text from yesterday, we get this conception of altitude, which is basically the higher, lower order pleasure system. You know, obviously with altitude, you know, there's a preeminence given to, you know, the sort of the healthy human pleasures, you know, the pleasures of the mind, philosophy, learning, intelligence, those kind of things. These things are apparently pleasurable. I've been into philosophy for a while. I don't know if that's true, but that's the kind of idea. But I think that where Mill makes a pretty big transition is, obviously, I wrote there's another axis that Mill brings in, and this is to transition the system away from the seeking of individual pleasure to the seeking of communal pleasure or happiness, right? To read the kind of another famous quote, I'm sure most either former first year philosophy students, or if you're looking to take class, you'll definitely encounter this. The creed, I'll just read it out. The creed which accepts as the foundation of moral utility, talk about what utility is, or the greatest happiness principle, holds that actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. By happiness is intended pleasure, and by the absence of pain, and by unhappiness, pain, and the privation of pleasure. Basically, that in making decisions, you know, transitioning away a little bit from hedonism and to a more consequentialist or utilitarian kind of thing, yes, you are making decisions based around pleasure, but you're not necessarily making them based around your personal pleasure outcome, but instead a like wider communal outcome, right? Am I making the decisions that are going to make the most people happy at the most time, et cetera, et cetera? And that might mean that I'm not physically pleasured or satisfied necessarily, but I might still be doing the right thing because a whole bunch of other people are, or that's out, my lack is sort of, you know, outbalanced by, yeah, you know, the communal infusion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's actually a really good point to raise, is this communal idea, because first of all, it does go back to what I had brought up earlier about the fact that ethical phenomena only seem to really emerge under plural situations where there's really more than one person, and where you have interactions, where people are in dialogue with each other, whether verbally or practically. This also goes back to how Mill talks about what higher pleasures are, right? There's something that I noticed that I think is, maybe it's kind of purposeful, because I don't know if Mill is, well, I'll say this. So I'll just read here. If I am asked what I mean by difference of quality and pleasures, this at this point, Mill has introduced the idea of higher and lower pleasures. If I am asked what I mean by difference in quality of pleasures, or what makes one pleasure more valuable than another, merely as a pleasure, except it's being greater in amount, there is but one possible answer. Of two pleasures, if there be one to which all or almost all who have experience of both give a decided preference, irrespective of any feeling of moral obligation to prefer it, that is the more desirable pleasure. Now, I find this passage really interesting now in the time that we've been talking, Hale, because I think you're absolutely right that this goes back to this idea of pleasure for the greatest number, right? That this is a communal thing, that what a higher pleasure is actually to be decided intersubjectively, and that this takes us out of a purely subjective ethical hedonism and fully into a moral utilitarianism. I find this passage a little suspect, though, only because when I want to know what is meant by a quality, I don't necessarily want to be told how to detect it. I want to be told what it is. And Mill does not seem to give me what precisely a higher pleasure is. He just tells me how to detect it. And I think that might be a little bit of, he might be doing some good metaphysical wrist slapping, in a way. He might be evading to talking about something that can't be talked about. But on the other hand, it's like, well, you're not really saying what, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think, like, as you're kind of saying, I think one of the most important move and kind of one of the major problems that we were sort of discussing up to this point with something like hedonism is the subjectivity problem, right? Like, if it's just about you and your own pleasure seeking, what kind of system is that? It seems chaotic. It kind of seems to be missing the point of morality, of ethical systems in general. So now we've sort of moved it to being like, okay, it's a communal happiness. Like, this is that we've got, like I said, we've got this new axis going on, right? So we've got the axis of altitude, quality, but then we've got the axis of like the communal, not quantity in terms of the amount of pleasure for you, the individual, quantity in terms of the effect on the wider communal aspect. But I do agree. I actually also highlighted that passage. There is a problem there, which is, as you said, it doesn't really make any distinction what that is. And you could then respond, okay, well, like a little bit of a thought experiment. If the sort of, you know, goalpost is basically people agree, oh, this is the best thing. Well, you know, I wrote beside it, actually, in my book, I wrote like the Soma problem, if Soma being the drug from Brave New World, where everyone is just like hopped up on like the perfect narcotic that everyone's just like, oh, this is great. Like, you know, like it's like, you know, if it leaves open the option that, hey, you could actually, what if you engineered some sort of narcotic or system or behavior or whatever that like pretty much everyone agreed was the best. So now it's Mill just saying, okay, well, if that's the case, then, you know, we are going to commit to like, you know, the Soma model of morals and like y'all just be hopped up on pills all the time and all that kind of stuff. And again, then we're kind of back to this, like there's something that seems very like icky and not consistent as a moral system with that. It kind of falls prey to similar problems. Just you're sort of just like moving it from like a subjective issue to an intersubjective issue. Well, now everybody, instead of it just being you all hopped up on Soma, now everyone's on Soma. So it's like, all right, okay, sure, I guess.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, that's absolutely like a situation that could happen, but I feel like I'll get to this point first, and then I guess I can bring up the other one, is that I think that there's actually something really... I don't know if I would call it genius, but I think that there's something really psychologically keen about what Mill is trying to do there. And I think it's kind of implicit in any attempt to ground essentially what Mill is trying to do is exploit the social factor of judgments, right? I think that I guess this is still subject to like what crowd you're in when you make this judgment, but I think in Mill's own time, he probably would have been able to bank on the fact that in a plural situation, not just like imagining this as a thought experiment, but genuinely going out there and trying to curry the opinion of others, you would be very hard pressed to have people admit to other people that they were like into certain things, that this is like, oh, I would do Soma or something like that. Well, they wouldn't admit that in front of their family or their friends or something like that in any kind of like real social situation, because there still is like this sense of, I guess like certain kinds of decency. There's certain social milieu that uphold certain ideas. And this goes to the other thing that I was going to say too, is I find it really interesting the family resemblance between the things that people tend to assign to be these like higher values, you know, like think of, you know, his examples are like philosophy, fine art, good conversation, all of these like very refined Victorian things. But I'm thinking like, what about Dostoevsky's Underground Man, who says, you know, isn't there pleasure in a toothache? You know, there's some kind of refined pleasure that the underground man has in having a toothache or beating his head against a wall and wanting to resist, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Isn't there something refined about that? Well, what about, these, I'm using this term family resemblance, it's difficult to pin down what precisely all these things have in common, but we understand that they all do resemble each other in this sort of fine way. There is this almost social aspect that I think in a plural situation, when we are called on to express our opinion in a social situation, certain things would be excluded just from like out of pure almost face, as it were.
There is a pretty strong counter to this in some ways. Actually, I forget his name, but I remember when he took a class in consequentialism upper level, you know, some time ago, university, I read one of his books, which was a very boring and detailed consequentialist theory, basically a 200-page book on how consequentialism might work. But one concept or idea that he brought up that I thought was really interesting was this idea that, you know, if you're going to have a thought experiment or if you're going to be concerned with some sort of universality, the question you need to ask yourself is not what if everybody did this, it's what if everybody could do X, right? So the difference between what if everybody did X, well, what if everybody did Soma, that'd be a big problem, versus, okay, well, what about, what if, as you're kind of saying, what if Soma was actually like a thing? Would everybody do it? And the answer is no. Right? Like people, not everyone would. Now, is that a boon for consequentialism, really, or hedonism? I don't really think so. But I do think that it's kind of like the simple examples of, oh, just everybody would be on drugs probably doesn't make sense because not everybody would want to choose to be on drugs. But this was the point I was going to get to. Why would that be? And, you know, Mill has a passage a little bit later on where he says, where he goes on to say, its most appropriate appellation is a sense of dignity, which all human beings possess in one form or another, and in some, though by no means exact proportion of their higher faculties, and which is so essential a part of happiness to those in whom it is strong. So basically what Mill is saying there is that these higher faculties, as you're talking about, are important because they're imbued with a certain sense of, like, of dignity around being a human being. I think that that's an astute observation as to why they're important, but it kind of leaves open this question of like, well, what is this? If this dignity thing is so important, what is it about? And is it actually a function of utility or consequentialism, or is it reflective of some other missing components that we're trying to get at here, right? Like, why is it so important that human beings have this sense of dignity, just what we talked about earlier, like the sense of, could even say, like, you sort of get into senses of, like, a real sense of personal authenticity, which may not be linked to any particular action or activity or pleasure.
Yeah. I think that's the other kind of problem that I've always had with this distinction that Mill has drawn between higher and lower pleasures, is that it seems like... the higher pleasure or the high aspect of it, what promotes dignity and what allows us to be fully human, it almost threatens to be more important than pleasures. And I draw that on the possibility of, so I've always wondered why Mill, maybe because Mill is writing a defense of utilitarianism, and so it wouldn't be very apologetic to talk about this distinction, but I don't see a utilitarianism that draws a distinction between higher and lower pleasures that also doesn't draw a distinction between higher and lower pains, right? Some pains that might actually be of higher value than other pains. So it's very easy to imagine someone making a sacrifice and that almost having a value, right? There being dignity in being able to make mistakes. I mean, think about people's worries about things like paternalism and stuff like that, where people are not allowed to make their own mistakes. They're not allowed to go out and screw up for themselves. There's almost a kind of value in bumping up against reality for yourself. It allows a person a certain amount of dignity to hurt themselves. It's why we don't ban everything that is just bad all the time, you know? You can go out and you can do drugs, you can smoke, you can do all kinds of things that are not very good for you, but because it would be, there's not just because, you know, it would be paternalistic or something like that. There, maybe smoking and things like that is not a very good example, because I'm trying to think of cases of things where bad things happen and we say that's actually, there's almost a kind of dignity to it. There's almost a kind of beauty in that suffering. I think there's always like, it's kind of tragic in certain ways.
As we come to the, like the close of the episode, I this was always been in the back of my mind for the whole discussion and always is with these sorts of discussions, which is the problem of, you know, sacrifice or self-sacrifice, as you already kind of brought up. And I actually think that'd be like a great episode, because it's something that it's kind of nagged me for like a long time. But I do think it's a great example of, you know, people can make decisions or do things that are going to be overtly painful that we think have a certain degree of dignity. And one person could say, I think one of the counters is you could say, oh, well, it does good for other people. But there are situations where that sacrifice is in vain, right? Like maybe many cases where it's not successful, right? Imagine someone rushing into a fire, you know, rushing into a fire home to go save, you know, a child or a family or whatever, and they don't make it, like they're not successful. You know, there's still clearly some sort of dignity or moral fortitude in making that act, even though it was failure, and everyone is more upset by like the outcome than had the person not in some alternate world, like just stood outside and still been alive, right? Like they still would have been alive for their family and all this kind of stuff. But we still have some sort of admiration or respect or whatever for that individual, which clearly is indicative of consequences and outcomes not being the full measure of activity.
Something like this higher, this dignity, regardless of pleasure or pain at all, seems to be a greater North Star for value or for what we think is worth pursuing. So we've been discussing Stephen Looper's article or section of his book, The Philosophy of Death, the way that Feldman brings up higher and lower pleasures. And so we decided to go into John Stuart Mill, considering that he is the sort of touchstone for having brought higher and lower pleasures into Western ethics. So you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been Brandon, and I've been joined by Hale. Thank you for listening.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. The support from our awesome community helps keeping the station diverse and independent. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. At midday, it might seem like the birds that were so active in the morning have gone silent, maybe even vanished. But there are some birds that, much like people, rally in the afternoon, offering a second chance to see and hear them. Cormorants are sleek water birds that dive for fish. There are cormorant species found all over the world. The double-crested cormorant is the most common in North America. During the summer breeding season, this species has two peak times for hunting. The first around 9 a.m., and the second around 3 p.m. So if you're out in the afternoon, you might find a cormorant hard at work diving for fish. Cormorants don't spend most of their time looking for food, though. They catch their prey efficiently, letting them spend most of their day loafing around, drying their feathers in the sun, and croaking at their neighbors. Sounds like an ideal day for many human anglers, too. Reel in a few fish, then kick back and relax. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Third Note is grateful to former board member and photographer extraordinaire Owen Deutsch and his wife Rona Talcott for their strong support over the years.